Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to the very latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for downloading. And my thanks to people who generously support this program every month with their voluntary subscriptions, including Christopher Welsh, Chad Leverins, Larry Doers in Costa Rica, and Don Sisney. If you're able and you'd like to help, join us. Come to my website at peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and those voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. This is a first of a three-part series about the CIA on campus here in the United States. And this is produced in collaboration with Sibel Edmonds and BoilingFrogsPost.com. You're about to hear the lead contributor and editor of a new volume called The CIA on Campus, Essays on Academic Freedom and the National Security State. Remember, the charter of the CIA back in 1947 or 48 said it would never operate inside the United States or focus on American citizens residing in the United States. Remember?
Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And today we begin a new series of interviews in the Boiling Frog series focused on the way the Central Intelligence Agency recruits young people on college campuses across the United States. Philip Zwirling is an assistant professor of English at the University of Texas Pan American, and he is the editor and a major contributor to a new book called The CIA on Campus, subtitled Essays on Academic Freedom and the National Security State. Phil Zwirling, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and I really appreciate the work that you and colleagues have put into this book, because you identify a serious issue, and you come at it from a number of perspectives. You talk about the history of the agency and the history of its recruitment tactics. You talk about the role of the American Psychological Association in participating in torture programs and other things that are clearly a violation of their central mission. You have a first-person account of an individual who spied for the CIA, who had been recruited on campus back in the 1960s, and his campus in Iowa is the scene of recruiting in recent years as well. Your book begins, and you really caught my attention, Phil, because I once went to Grenada on a sailing vacation, and I won't bore you with the details, but it was a little bit like Gilligan's Island. We had a bad sailboat. But you focus on a trip that you took there just prior to Reagan's invasion of Grenada in the mid-1980s.
That's right. And if you've been to Grenada, we have to begin with the fact that it really is one of the most beautiful places on Earth, with a volcano, an extinct volcano in the center, and lush greenery all around, and the most beautiful sea surrounding it. So my wife and I went primarily for a vacation, and fell into it because I was then minister of the First Unitarian Church in Los Angeles, and a member of our church had a daughter who was in Grenada editing the new newspaper that the New Jewel Movement, which had succeeded Edmund Gerry in power in Grenada, and she was putting it out, and I thought, well, you know, how great to choose a place that we could go to where at least distantly we had a connection, someone who might be able to show us around, and where we could combine not only sun and sand, but also a view of rapidly developing a revolutionary program in an island there. Mm-hmm. So we went down, and you know, it was in the midst of an unrelenting disinformation campaign by our government against Grenada, and it was the first time that I've ever had the opportunity, which most Americans don't get, to one, hear and be surrounded and inundated with this disinformation campaign about how they're building a special airport and a special runway down there to handle Soviet bombers that will then be able to strike the United States, and they're installing special submarine pens for Soviet nuclear submarines, missile-carrying submarines that would threaten the United States, and to hear all these very threatening warnings, and to be in that world surrounded by U.S. media painting that picture, and then take a plane and be there and say to yourself, this is not the reality. It was, in fact, one of the most laid-back places on Earth I've ever been. And my experience was to wander around with no formal introductions into places that I would never have gotten in other countries, including the prime minister's offices, to do it without the aid of the contact I thought I had at the newspaper, because it turned out she was going to be vacationing on another island. So I literally went there with no introduction, no standing in any way, just going down and talking to Grenadians, whether it was on the streets or in offices, in churches, and seeing that everything I had been told was untrue. It was literally black and white, and that has helped me keep in perspective the media stories that we have been handed through the years since then about Nicaragua, about Cuba, about Iran, that so often we are, you know, although we believe our press is free, although we believe that each of us is well-educated and well-read and up-to-date, that we cannot escape the picture that's painted by our government, which is often far from reality.
Well, and Phil, just if you'll indulge me a moment, in 25 years ago, I was doing a morning show in San Francisco when the whole Grenada story broke. And I got members of the Fire Sign Theater to perform a skit with us about how the U.S. forces came in on jet skis to Grenada to liberate the island. And the final line from one of the Fire Sign Theater guys posing as a CIA executive said, well, we build it and then we blow it up. It's the perfect job creation cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And what is, I think, really important 25 years later is that the official and false narrative still holds. And most Americans believe that we liberated Grenada from the clutches of dangerous communists who were going to build an important base there to, as you said, attack the United States. That was never true. It's not true today. But to the extent that people have any awareness of Reagan's invasion of Grenada, It was an American white hat operation to liberate these people from the demons of communism.
Well, exactly, and we have Clint Eastwood's movie, Heartbreak Ridge, showing just how brave Americans were to invade. The reality was that the entire island was able to muster 1,000 soldiers and perhaps a couple of hundred Cuban construction workers, and we invaded with 10,000 Marines, plus aircraft carriers, jet planes, bombers, what have you. It was totally pathetic. I mean, even Margaret Thatcher, Reagan's British clone and the Iron Lady, was tried to talk Reagan out of it, just saying it was such a David and Goliath type of operation that it would poison U.S. relations in Latin America for many years to come. And in fact, it has, because it's been a train of similar kinds of, you know, interventions that we've made there. But I want to say I can understand how the Fireside Theater show would have been funny, but there is such a dark side to this. One of the things I did when I was in Grenada, and that point paints it really as a tragedy for me, was to go out to the airport at Point Salines, the airport, the so-called controversial super-secret airport, where they were building a 9,000-foot runway that we were told was too long for just tourist planes, was really meant for Soviet bombers, to go out there and to, when the Cubans basically invited the entire island to come down on the anniversary of the Moncada attacks in Cuba in 1956, I believe, mm-hmm. and to wander around the so-called super-secret base where there were no guards, where I never saw anyone carrying weapons, where I drank beer with the Grenadians and met Cubans. I speak Spanish, so they were happy to see anybody who spoke Spanish. They were homesick. They took me unbidden into their barracks, showed me where they lived and how they lived. Now, these were construction workers. I know the U.S. tried to paint them as paramilitary, Cuban military veterans, but mm-hmm. in fact, they were kind of pudgy, 40-year-old guys who had on the walls of the barracks the pictures of their wives and girlfriends, who were very homesick, who wanted to finish their job and go home. And the tragedy is that many of them died during the U.S. invasion. And it was from my point of view, it was a crime.
And the U.S. media painted those construction workers as if they were all clones of Che Guevara.
Exactly. And they were clones of U.S. construction workers who tend to be the same all around the world.
Now, Phil, in the opening essay that you wrote for the book, The CIA on Campus, you delineate what you call the template for terror. And let me read the bullet points here, and then we'll discuss these elements and how they apply to so many targets of America's foreign policy, particularly when it involves covert operations by our CIA. You start off, first, find or create an enemy. Second, demonize that enemy. Third, wage economic war on that new enemy. Four, manipulate public opinion and political life within the target country. Number five, disturb domestic tranquility through bribery, embargo, and sabotage. Number six, kill selected targets through a CIA program of assassination. Seven, recruit, train, arm, and pay a native mercenary force to topple the government. Eight, invade. Nine, the CIA runs it all. And number 10, the CIA terror template is refined, empowered, and staffed from our college campuses. And this is very important because you establish this critical linkage between the actions and history of the Central Intelligence Agency and its long-term, ongoing recruitment program at American college campuses. Let's start first with the template for terror. How many times have you seen this model replicated in American history since the CIA was formed at the end of World War II?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, more times than I can count. We could certainly just list the number of U.S. interventions in Latin America during that time, or go back to Iran in the 50s. It really is kind of a, almost, I would say, a cookie-cutter approach to foreign subversion. This is how we deal with our enemies abroad. After Grenada, I spent quite a bit of time in Nicaragua, and I saw it at work there. Kermit Roosevelt has talked about how it was applied in Iran to overthrow Mossadegh and bring in the Shah. And Stephen Kinsner has talked about how it was used in Guatemala to overthrow Jacobo Arbenz, and then many others have documented the use of this template in Chile to overthrow Allende and bring in Pinochet.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does start on the college campuses. I think that's the key for me as a college professor. The CIA has to generate at least 10,000 job applications every year, from which they hire 1,000 new agents, and these people come overwhelmingly from our campuses. Frank Wisner, one of their early program directors, said, you know, we need access to the best brains in America, and that's on college campuses. And then 20 years later, one of their spokespeople said, we now have, under a CIA contract, enough college professors to staff a large university in the United States.
And Phil, you know, we were led to believe during the 1980s that the Church Commission and other investigations had led to reform of the agency, and that many of the excesses and abuses had been reined in. And in particular, we were led to believe that recruitment and infiltration of academia had either been sharply dialed back or completely eliminated. From your experience, was there any reduction or elimination of CIA recruitment at any point after, say, the Church Commission issued its report?
Well, I think the Church report and a year later the report that came out of the House from Otis Pike were devastating for the CIA. They exposed crimes, subversion, the violation of the contract under which the CIA had originally been set up. So I think the CIA then withdrew. I think it was so politically hot and political opinion had turned against them that they certainly had to lower their profile. There's a great memo from the vice chancellor at UC Berkeley, who again was paid secretly by the CIA as a consultant, who said, you know, you've got to lower your profile. One thing you do is do your recruiting in the summer or whenever the college newspaper is not being published. So they were looking for any way to lower their profile. And of course, some of the presidents at that time, I think Carter for a while, were very, you know, raised the issue of human rights, and that certainly conflicted with the activities of the CIA abroad. And then there were upswellings of student protests on campus. We saw that in the 80s, and we saw it in the early 90s when students confronted CIA recruiters and CIA speakers on campus. But, you know, 9/11 changed things in many ways, and I think the CIA saw an entry and a way to get back onto campuses when people were afraid, when people thought that extreme measures had to be taken. And I think we're going to be seeing, I would say it may take another 10 years, but there's going to be, again, a revulsion once people see the details of what we've done at Guantanamo, what we did in Poland and Belarus and Cairo in terms of torturing prisoners and what we've done on campus. So the worst of what's happening now has not yet come out, and that's the scariest part because so much bad stuff has already come out.
I'd like to read a brief passage written by David Price, one of the essayists who contributed to your book. He writes, "A national surge of fear following 9/11 brought with it a cultural, quote-unquote, memory wipe that overwrote what had once been broad understandings of the dangers that the FBI, CIA, NSA, and other domestic and international intelligence agencies present to the freedom of thought, political discourse, and dissent. That fear following the 9/11 attacks spawned the rapid adoption of the Patriot Act, and soon the CIA and other American intelligence agencies gained expanded extrajudicial powers at home and abroad, in some cases having powers restored to them that had been specifically withdrawn after the public airing of past abuses. As the Bush and Obama administration's terror wars have grown, so have the powers and presence of the CIA, a zeitgeist pressing for allegiance to increased military and intelligence spending overshadows public memories of past agency atrocities while budget cuts gut public services. Now, this is a very powerful statement, and I agree with what it says, and that is that 9/11 was used to justify all kinds of things that were inconceivable to average Americans and aware Americans prior to those events. And without relitigating the events of 9/11 and whether the official narrative is accurate or not, I think it's very clear that it was used as a pivot point to roll back our constitutional rights and to help erect a police state in our country. And people cringe at the term police state, and they say, oh, it can't happen here. You know, I can still hire a lawyer and defend myself. Ask Casey Anthony. But the levels of surveillance, the infiltration of peaceful groups that have no terrorist intent or connections by the FBI and presumably other arms of our intelligence community, we've seen a real creep and massive expansion of these activities. And there is almost no political opposition from members of either party. The oversight functions of the Congress have been essentially dismantled. And the American people seem, I guess, equally unaware, and those who are aware seem unconcerned.
Well, Peter, I think that's exactly right, and that's the reason that we did the book. And so I want to mention to your listeners right now that the book is available from McFarlane & Company Publishers, and they can just online and find McFarlane's website and order the book. It's something that I never expected to get involved in, but when we found the CIA on our campus, we started getting in touch with other academics and people across the country and found the CIA was active on many campuses. And so this book contains essays, as you said, by seven academics and one former CIA agent. And our aim is to get the word out. I don't think people, this is not being covered in the media, as you say. I think people need to read this book and get involved. And the one thing that the CIA has feared more than anything else has been exposure and publicity. They operate in the darkness. They operate behind closed doors. And so this kind of conversation has to take place on every campus, because the CIA is approaching administrations, college administrations, with promises of millions of dollars. And these promises are coming in very tough economic times. And so college administrators who think there's not going to be a downside, who think they can quietly take the money and run a program without generating opposition, are very likely to do so. But administrations that think that students are going to be upset about this, that think there are going to be stories in the student, in the campus and community newspapers, who think that perhaps faculty are going to be a little chagrined about this, are much more likely to say no. And that's the kind of action that we're trying to spur now.
Now, Phil, if you can pause just a moment here, your fabulous governor, Rick Perry, who wants to be our next American president, I think would take a dim view of your efforts, because this is a job killer book. I mean, the CIA is coming to your campus to offer jobs to students and potential graduates, and you are interfering.
Yes, well, that argument certainly has been made. But the problem is that nothing that the CIA does is above board, and that includes their recruitment pitches. I would be very happy to invite the CIA on campus to recruit students if I could be there with the recruiter and have equal time to speak to those students. I have no problem. Well, I have a problem, but I would be less concerned if students knew what they were getting into when they wind up as targets of CIA recruitment. You know, one of our deans, who was very strongly behind getting the CIA on campus, said to assure the faculty that any students recruited into the program, would serve as analysts and not as covert operators. And an analyst, it does the kind of thing that the CIA was originally set up to do, which is to analyze intelligence, to prepare intelligence reports, and report to people who make decisions. And I think we might all agree that our politicians need all the intelligence reports they can get. But there's another part of the CIA. 20 to 30% of the personnel who are involved in covert operations, and this has basically evolved very quickly under government sanction, that these are the folks we turn to for dirty tricks, for assassinations, for coup d'etats, all the kinds of things, number one, that we're not supposed to be doing and that politicians don't want to do publicly. So how the CIA, how the dean could say, oh, all of our students will only become analysts, his response was, well, the CIA told me that's the way it would be. So either people are disingenuous or incredibly naive, and students need to know what they might be asked to do. And so in the book, it was very important for us to include that one chapter from Vern Lyon, a fellow who had been recruited into the CIA as a student and whose life was basically ruined by the CIA because of the terrible things that he was asked to do and asked to participate in, as he saw both his moral life and his emotional life destroyed slowly as he succumbed to CIA pressures, first to spy on students, to spy on his professors, and later to go undercover as a covert agent in Cuba. So we want students to see that side of the CIA, and I would be very happy to join a CIA agent on a recruitment tour across the United States and campuses everywhere, if it would allow us to present that picture of the CIA.
Right. I really enjoyed reading the book. One of the things I was looking for in the book, and I don't think there was much on that in this book because there's so much that people can include in one book, and I wanted to talk to you about that and get your take on it. Has to do with the another line of activities by the CIA in campuses that has been going on for decades and decades. I will give you one real-life example from the 1960s. My uncle, one of my uncles from Iran, he got a scholarship to get his graduate degree in Alabama, University of Alabama, aerospace engineering. Mm-hmm. And he got here in 1960s, and one of the things that took place, he was a political activist, he always was a political activist, and he continued those activism here in the United States while he was attending universities. And by activism, I mean, writing essays and forming groups about the monarchy and the need for democracy in Iran, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of the things that happened was the CIA were reporting his activities in the United States from the university, all the papers he was writing, and this is not during the internet era. This is when, you know, that information would stay in the school, and it was not all over the place online to be found, to SAVAK, which was the Shah regime intelligence service, police and intelligence service. And the communication went both ways. And at some point, per request from SAVAK, the CIA pressured the university to took away his my uncle's scholarship, even though he was, 4.0 average student. I mean, he was really, really successful in his academic in terms of his academic performance, and remove his student visa and have him send my uncle back to Iran so he would be arrested and tortured like some other family members I have over there had to endure and go through. And my uncle, of course, didn't return to Iran, and he went to Japan, and later he got his PhD in England. But later, these documents, after the revolution, became public, all the archives, and it shows, just on my family alone, all the communication between the universities, and these are the CIA people in the universities, with the SAVAK in Iran, reporting on the Iranian students' activities and letting this, atrocious intelligence police agency in Iran know what these students were up to while they were studying here in the United States, and vice versa. And this was one of the things that I was looking for. That's another line of activities by the CIA that did not stop after the Church Committee, because when I was working at the FBI, and we monitored and investigated and analyzed information that was coming from the diplomatic community, like in this case, the Turkish diplomatic community. And this was before 9/11, these files, 1996 till 2001. And at any given date, the CIA and the State Department regularly were reporting, providing the embassy and the other diplomatic institutions in the United States, and this is in late 90s, on the activities of the Turkish students here who were either active with the human rights organizations on Kurdish minority issues or on the, you know, activism against the military regime in Turkey, etc. But they were providing daily reports, and they being the State Department, a.k.a. State Department, it's usually the CIA, but they usually contact the diplomatic communities for the reports as the State Department, and providing them with the list, the names, and they would fax them the papers that these students had written in the classes. And again, this is late 90s, even before 9/11. So I just wanted to get your take on these lines of activities when they know, you know, with our so-called allies that have dictatorships in their countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia or if it's Bahrain or if it's Turkey or Israel or Pakistan, that's one line of activities by our government, by the CIA, to provide the intelligence and the police agencies in those ally countries of the activities of the students coming from those countries.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Sybil, and I think if when our government gets in bed with basically dictatorships that rule by terror around the world, whether it be Iran under the Shah or Chile under Pinochet, once we've made a commitment to those dictatorships, our intelligence agency, the CIA, works with Bina in Chile or Sabak in Iran, and they are going to trade information, and it's going to be to the detriment of individuals who get ground up in that system. The other part of that we've seen, and Vern Lyon talks about this as an ex-CIA agent, as a student under a contract to the CIA, one of his jobs was to seek out foreign students at Iowa State University. And this was to compile information about them. Now, he did not have the job of doing the next step, which was either to investigate them officially, or what the CIA often looked for is to recruit them as double agents, to recruit them so that they will return to their country of origin and continue to work with the CIA. And this was documented through the Church Committee, and it can have two likely consequences. A number of these foreign students went back and were under such tremendous pressure of feelings of guilt and anxiety and fear. Often the CIA not only paid them but had some incriminating evidence about them and could blow their cover at any time. So they were in increasingly untenable positions once they returned. Many of them, perhaps as many as 40 of these students, committed suicide because they were unable to deal with the pressures the CIA put them under. And then, of course, there would be the students who continued to cooperate with the CIA, who were not particularly sophisticated or trained agents, who were discovered by their own governments and then suffer the consequences that way. So it was a very sensitive area, and foreign students are even more at the mercy of the CIA on campus than U.S. students.
But how are they actually carrying out this? For example, obtaining the academic papers submitted to a particular professors, because they must have these agreements and these working relationship and engagements in place with some of these professors in these universities.
Right.
To get such raw data. I mean, it's not only activities, let's say, in the cafeteria or when the students are talking among themselves, but to even get the actual academic papers submitted by certain graduate students to their professors, and quickly, and I'm talking about almost real time, before even those documents are archived with the by the administrative personnel in the universities and submitted to the embassies and say, look, this is what this student is up to. And for example, let's say one of them is a Kurdish activist and has written this, just written this, let's say 2 days ago, this particular paper for XYZ professor on the human rights conditions for the Kurdish minority in Turkey. And that quickly, to get that paper and right away notify the Turkish embassy or other diplomatic communities, that means then they have direct access to the professor.
Well, and that historically that has been the case. The professors are paid to suggest likely recruits to the CIA. Their historical records where they have turned student papers over to the CIA. So we know that happens. And remember that the CIA is selective. I don't think they care about what's happening over in the English department. You mentioned your uncle in aerospace, and that was where the former CIA agent in our book was recruited out of an aerospace program. So they're looking at aerospace and engineering more and more at psychology today for so-called touchless interrogation techniques. They are selective, and they have a list of things they're looking for in terms of student expertise and people that they're keeping an eye on. And I would think Kurds especially, who governments of Turkey and Iraq and Syria all see as troublesome and dangerous, are going to come in for particular surveillance as well.
One more question on this with maybe possibly more details, and that is, let's say with a particular professor. I was attending George Washington University. That's where I was graduated for my bachelor degrees. But a particular professor of mine, and this was for the political science, he actually came, because I speak four or five different languages, and tried to recruit me and have me send resume to the CIA. But let's say with the professors that they have this arrangement with, and they pay them, in what form do they pay? Because what, the check can't come from the central intelligence agencies, and of course it's not going to be in an envelope as cash. So how do you think these working arrangements, paid working arrangements work? How do they get paid, these professors? In what form?
I'm not sure that I would rule out the check and the cash, Sybil. For example, Vern Lyon, as a
right.
student at Iowa State, every week got an envelope of cash from a CIA operative who appeared on campus carrying a certain color backpack outside the student union, and as they went and talked together, Vern was slipped cash, money. So I think it can operate on that basis, indeed. And there, for professors, we need to keep in mind that there are larger incentives than cash. I think students at a lower end of the economic ladder, a couple of hundred dollars here and there makes a big difference. But professors are looking for career success. And career success in academia translates into publications. And we know that the CIA has subsidized certain journals and certain publications and has made sure that their editorial boards contained other CIA paid consultants, and so academics who cooperate get their articles published. When your articles are published, you move up. You get tenured and you get promoted. So that's, and then the university writes you the check, but your career has been subsidized by the CIA.
That's an excellent point. And Dr. Zwirling, that will bring me to another real life example of a very good friend, someone I respect tremendously. And he actually works with University of Texas. Maybe you know him, Professor Bill Weaver?
I don't.
Okay, he is with the El Paso Division of University of Texas.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Weaver, he actually was the person who encouraged me in 2004 to form the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, my organization. We have about over 100 national security whistleblowers from the CIA and FBI and DIA, the intelligence and law enforcement agencies, and he was a great help in helping us to go and ask for hearings in Congress and go to various offices, work on, you know, passing legislation related to, you know, whistleblowers, which, of course, never got anywhere. And he was our legal advisor, basically, as an organization that is not really bureaucratic and doesn't have this budget to have these people on board and on payroll, et cetera. And he's a very good friend. Again, he's a man I really like and consider a friend. But after we became high profile as the organization, and we've had little bit of media coverage because the mainstream media, they don't like these issues, he was given this promotion, and he was put in this position where he is in charge of facilitating recruitment from El Paso campus of the graduate students with Defense Intelligence Agency, CIA, and FBI. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when this took place, basically, you know, we are still friends, but I no longer can even work with him because there will be a conflict of interest. You know, I used to send some of our whistleblower cases, some of them were not public, from intelligence agencies, and consult with him and say, well, what should we do? Is this a case that should go to court? Or should this person actually come forward, make this public, considering what they say about classification? But that basically ended that relationship there. And it was amazing how it took place. As soon as it became visible, he was, you know, promoted. And now he's in this position of conflict of interest. He can't work with us. Actually, he's working for the other side in some ways.
Well, I think that's the situation of serving two masters. And the university is supposed to be a place set aside. It's not supposed to be, from my point of view, at the whims of current common political enthusiasms or political pressure or industrial concerns. It's a place where educated people not only help to educate students, but pursue research, and that research is supposed to be, not beholden to anybody who's paying the bill, so that research gets rigged in one way or another. There's supposed to be a sense of free inquiry and a search for truth, and that gets continually undercut. And again, especially in hard economic times, as universities struggle and they look for sponsors. I mean, we have on campuses across the country, there are research projects being underwritten by cigarette manufacturers, by drug manufacturers, and by the Department of Defense.
Well, and your university sold the naming rights to an airline that's out of business.
Did we? you have to keep in mind that the University of Texas is a system, statewide system, and it's a very big state of 9 academic campuses and I think 5 medical campuses. So when you say my university, I'm sitting on one of 9 campuses in the southernmost reaches of Texas, just above the Rio Grande border with Mexico.
And what is the origin of the Pan American name? It didn't come from the airline. I was just kidding.
No, okay. This was a. I must say that the Rio Grande Valley, as we call it, is a very interesting part of Texas. It is demographically quite different from the rest of the state, being largely Democrat and largely Mexican American. And this began as a junior college back in the 20s, morphed into a teacher training institution, morphed into a private college, and was then absorbed into the UT system. I believe in the 70s, when they were trying to increase, the UT system was being sued for the absence of Mexican American students, and by absorbing Pan American College, they balanced off their ethnic diversity, and so that's how we became part of the UT system. It's now a college of 19,000 students and 1,000 or so professors.
And I hope that the new ABC series Pan Am is popular there, because some friends of mine produced it, and we hope it's going to be a success. But, Professor, on a much more serious note, why is it that your university appears to be one of many targeted by the CIA as a platform for recruiting new employees?
Well, again, after 9/11, Congresswoman Jane Harman made the very, obvious point on the floor of the House of Representatives, saying in these times we need spies who look like their targets. She felt that somehow we'd been left napping in terms of our security because the CIA and other intelligence agencies were still largely staffed by white men. And I think that was a correct observation. Unfortunately, the consequences have been largely negative. The CIA then moved to target and recruit women, Mexican-American students, and so they established what are called academic centers of excellence at 22 minority-serving institutions across the country. You mentioned University of Texas at Paso, which is one of them, but also historically black universities, tribal institutions, majority female institutions across the country, and made an extraordinary push to diversify the workforce by recruiting these students. The real heartbreaking part of it for me is that in targeting minorities, they were targeting people who were most desperate for jobs and for careers and who didn't see a lot of alternatives and were most open to the blandishments of the CIA and the intelligence agency.
One of the other elements that I want to really commend you on in the book, and you touched on this briefly a few minutes ago, Phil, is the contribution by Stephen Solds, S-O-L-D-Z. And we have invited Stephen Solds to come on a subsequent episode of this program to go more in depth about these issues. But he focuses on the fact that CIA recruitment is not limited to either analysts, and we could pigeonhole that as librarian types, or operatives who imagine being a James Bond type special agent going out and killing people. And the CIA has gotten much more involved in cyber warfare and also in psychological aspects in many ways. They use psychological operations, which are a kind of psychological warfare. They use psychologists in the interrogation and torture systems that have been revived since 9/11. And they also have been using psychologists in data mining and other data collection. And I want to refer our listeners to a very powerful new report at BoilingFrogsPost.com from our video correspondent James Corbett, who takes a look at the CIA's venture capital arm that has been involved with Google, perhaps with Facebook, but they're doing a lot of data mining. And much of that interpretation and analysis is based on psychology. And I want to credit Dr. Jeffrey Kay, who is a psychologist here in the San Francisco Bay Area, who, together with Jason Leopold, has written a number of enterprise stories at truthout.org about the role of psychologists in the torture programs and the way the organization, the APA, the American Psychological Association, has essentially stood down from its position to protect its members and protect its clients by basically caving in to the government and going along with efforts to get psychologists to involve themselves in programs that are clear violations of the ethical standards of that profession.
Well, unfortunately, this should not be surprising. I think most people have heard of the 1960s experiment, mind control experiments that occurred on college campuses under the rubric of MK Ultra, at a time when students and others were, without their knowledge, given LSD to observe the effects on the subjects, effects that included suicide, breakdowns, institutionalizations. The shocking thing for me about MKUltra is not just that it occurred, but that it occurred on 40 different college campuses in Canada and the United States. That means that 40 college presidents, 40 college provosts, 40 college deans all knew about the program and approved it. And it's a clear violation of every kind of treatment of human subjects for experimentation. It explains why the CIA is here. Again, psychologists and others are conducting experiments all the time. They have the facilities. They have the background. Why not go to them? Let's see how people are affected by sleep deprivation, by strobe lights, by an unending din of noise. What kinds of torture can we inflict on people that doesn't leave marks? What kinds of ways can we control people's thoughts and behavior through psychology, drugs, and other mechanisms? So since the 60s and MKUltra, the CIA has been looking for those kinds of weapons for its arsenal, and they find them on college campuses.
Well, MKUltra is well exposed in a powerful book that was published about 18 months ago called A Terrible Mistake, and the author is H.P. Alborelli, Hank Alborelli. And it goes into incredible detail about the U.S. Development of bioweapons and chemical weapons and the extent to which they were used. And yes, it also exposes the collaboration of American universities and their campuses in many of these operations. And Phil, one of the other things that Dr. Jeff Kay has pretty well established is that psychologists and psychiatrists ended up either by choice or because they felt it was their duty or their job or they were intimidated into it, but they participated in experiments on human beings. And we know, for example, in the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, that it was being micromanaged from Washington. They were in real time able to monitor the abuse and torture of this man as he was repeatedly subjected to this false drowning process. And we know that psychologists and psychiatrists were involved. And so this was human experimentation. They were trying to figure out where the breaking point was, how far you could push somebody without actually killing them. And they were doing this under the basis of these bizarre memos from John Yoo that redefined torture techniques as not quite torture so that they would be legally absolved from doing it. And to date, we've had no accountability or investigations or prosecutions that have led to any serious consequences for these people who violated the standards of their profession.
Well, Peter, it's a sad. We should be talking to some theologians because I think it's a sad commentary on humanity that, in fact, college professors, most of whom got into the profession wanting to do good, wanting to teach, wanting to learn, wanting to read and to write, too easily succumbed to outside blandishments, to evil. The recent we knew about the syphilis experiments at Tuskegee. Now we know about the syphilis experiments down in Guatemala. These were all involved, presumably well-trained, not only well-trained doctors, family men and women who went home to their families and played catch with their kids in the backyard after infecting unsuspecting people with syphilis. So I have no explanation for it. It does go on. I think more than trying to explain it, we need to be committed to stopping it.
Phil, I just want to commend your book to people, and I'll let them read the book, and in particular, the final contribution you make, Nine Steps to a Spy-Free Campus. And so if you are in an academic environment, you're concerned about the CIA's role in a presence on your campus, not limited to recruitment, as we've discussed, I do recommend that essay to our listeners. But I'd like to close by asking you to describe for them the summer spy camp for kids, because this really parallels, we get in trouble when we make comparisons to the Nazis, particularly if we're not a right-wing nut, but the Hitler Youth and the brown-shirted young groups that include now the current Pope. These were, these were efforts, these were programs that were widely reviled in the post-war era, when we discovered what the German regime had been up to, Americans always took a very critical view of the way he indoctrinated young people. But our CIA is working with 15-year-olds, and I don't see how that's very much different from the Hitler Youth.
Well, the summer spy camps are a key component of CIA, Department of Defense, Department of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence grants to colleges across the country, including things like a dedicated reading room at campus libraries stocked with recruitment brochures for the various intelligence agencies. The subsidization of study abroad programs for college students to selective countries like China and Morocco, where students then turn over their notes after their trip to their CIA handlers. So one component of these million-dollar grants is that it commits each university to hold an annual summer camp for community young people. And these camps, which were originally called summer spy camps until people thought, gee, that is a little disturbing, and now often redefined as GOT intelligence camps, are free to high school students and middle school students in the selected communities, often from very deprived backgrounds, economically speaking, so that this is about their only chance to go to a summer camp, and are then not only have, quote, fun activities like trying to track down a dead body in the Rio Grande River using GPS coordinates, or building some engineering experiments, but are also one point or another during the summer camp to actual intelligence agents who convince them for the first time to consider a career in the intelligence service. Again, this is just part of the CIA recruitment process. And in the book, you can read reactions from some of these students, as reported in the media, one of them saying, gee, how cool this profession must be. I could be a spy when I get a chance. So it's a fairly effective program. They cut out all the, they don't have to deal with parents, they don't have to deal with educators, they go directly to rather impressionable children who certainly haven't read about the history of the CIA, are completely unaware of the past abuses, or certainly not any kind of balanced presentation, and the CIA continues to meet their recruiting needs. It's never too young to start bending the twig and hoping that there'll be a payoff further down the line.
I have two questions for you, Phil, before we wrap up. One is, what kind of reactions did you get from the top layers of these universities that you had as examples and case examples in your book, and then whether you faced any kinds of retaliations, or what kind of a reaction did you get in general from those actually involved in making these working arrangements with the CIA? And then the second question is, we are definitely going to recommend your book, and we're going to put it there. We believe everyone should read this book. This is an eye opener. But we were wondering if you're planning to have any kind of lecture series or conferences or speaking arrangements on this topic with your other authors that we can help provide coverage for, in terms of if they are being videotaped or if you have plans to take this further, this book, your work here.
Yeah, Sybil, I would say that for most professors and college students, just couldn't care less, unfortunately. You know, they don't see how this issue touches them directly. They'd rather not be bothered. And I have to say that campus is not a place filled with very brave people. We've certainly seen during the McCarthy period all kinds of witch hunts directed against college professors, many of whom lost their jobs at that time. And I think there's a certain level of a certain sense sense of, you know, you keep your head down and you can get ahead. And people need their jobs at this time. So I think the response has been quiet. There are those who are actively collaborating with the CIA. Their response is much noisier. They've distributed, you know, they've attacked some of our authors by writing to the administration. There have been accusations of racism, sexism, all kinds of things that that are meant and aimed at intimidating people, because the academy is unfortunately a very hierarchical place, and those of us are kind of at the bottom of the pecking order always have to worry about what the folks higher up are thinking about, whether they be chairs or deans or provosts, presidents, or regents. So it's on the other hand, I have to say, you know, you hear a lot from people who say, gosh, you know, who are willing to say this individually and personally to you, not put it in an email or say it at an open forum, who say, you know, I'm really glad you did this. I'm certainly going to, you know, reading it. Maybe I can use it as a class text, you know, and I certainly support you. But I think the breakthrough we've had on our own campus was getting our college council to unanimously condemn continuing cooperation with the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and then the Faculty Senate, based on that resolution, held a public campus meeting on the. And coincidentally or not, our president has announced that there are no current contracts with ODNI in the works or planned for the future. So, on that level, I think we can claim a victory, but it's the kind of thing that has to be done campus by campus. There are 4,000 institutions of higher learning across the country.
Trust that dean or chancellor, or do you think fingers were crossed as that assertion was offered?
Who knows? I think we have to. I guess that's the only thing that that Reagan said, perhaps, that I would endorse today. You trust and verify. You can do both. I think there are a lot of people of goodwill on campus who want to do the right thing and who need some encouragement to do that. So I think you can trust, and then there's no reason to let your guard down. Trust and verify. Keep an eye out what's really going on. And now I think we've heightened perceptions enough so that people are looking around and wondering and keeping an eye on things in ways they hadn't done before.
Philip Zwirling, he's an assistant professor of English at the University of Texas Pan American, and he edited and contributed to this new book of essays called The CIA on Campus. We will continue this series in future installments of the Boiling Frog interview program. Philip Zwirling, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Peter, and I'll mention again that the book is published by McFarland and Company Publishers, and McFarland can be found on the Internet, and the book can be ordered there.
Give me absolute control over every living soul in the sanity, baby. That's an order. Take the only tree that's left and stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me the back of the burning wall. Give me a star and say, Paul, I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.